Hi, this is Chip Heath, and this is the podcast on how to be more decisive. You may have had the experience, like I have, of waking up at 2 a.m., and as you're trying to fall back asleep, you make the mistake of starting to think about a decision that you're facing at home or at work, and all of a sudden the adrenaline kicks in, and you're wide awake, you're wired at 2 a.m. in the morning, and you can't get back to sleep. I've asked people in crowds that I've lectured to, and 95% of people raise their hands and say they've had exactly that same experience. I did have one woman a couple of weeks ago who raised her hand at the end in the Q&A period and said, you know that 2 a.m. thing you were talking about? And I said, yeah. She said, you know, that never happens to me. I said, wow, you must be doing something right. She said, yeah, for me it's always 3:15. Now, whether your 2 a.m. moment is at 2 a.m. or at 3:15, this podcast is designed to help you agonize less. One of the reasons Dan and I chose the title Decisive for our book is that's an aspiration many of us have. A lot of people told us, I think I'm a pretty good decision maker, but I wish I wasn't so slow. I wish I didn't worry so much. I want to be more confident in my decisions. And so as we go through this podcast, I'm going to make reference to things that are in our book. And so I'll assume that you've either read the book or have access to the index so you can look up the stories. So I won't tell the examples so much as refer to them. But I want to argue that the same RAP framework that's useful for making decisions and making better decisions should also help you make your decisions with more confidence without those agonizing 2 a.m. moments. So let me start by arguing that indecisiveness is most often a sign that you either don't have the right options or the right information about them. So people treat decision making as this elaborate process of, you know, creating an Excel spreadsheet to choose among alternatives. But the real trick is having the right alternatives in the spreadsheet in the first place. And the most common reason for agonizing is that you really don't like any of your alternatives. There's an analogy I like here to the negotiation classes that we often teach in business schools. A lot of MBA students sign up for a negotiation class because nobody feels confident going into a negotiation. We hate walking onto the car lot, negotiating with the car salesperson. We hate negotiating for a home that we're buying. And so a lot of students sign up for this course and they think they're going to learn magic. They think they're going to learn how to be persuasive under stress, how to come up with clever bargaining ploys that convince the other side to agree. And the first lesson that they learn, and actually the most useful lesson, is that your strength in negotiation is not a function of your persuasiveness as a negotiator. It's a function of your alternative to negotiating. There's even a jargon label for it. It's called the BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. So if I'm walking into a car negotiation, and I know that I could sell my car, used car, to a neighbor down the street for $1,000, no matter how persuasive the other negotiator is, no matter how vicious or how skilled they are, and how bad I feel about my negotiation skills, nothing that person can do can convince me to sell the car for less than $1,000 to them, because that's my BATNA. I know I can walk down the street and sell it to my neighbor. And so I can walk in with the calm confidence that I'm never going to get into a situation with a BATNA of $1,000 where I do worse than that. And I think the analogy for decision making is similar. Good decision making is a process of finding better alternatives. So it's not about being clever, about being choosing. It's not about learning some trick to stop agonizing. It's about learning to go and find better alternatives in a situation where we don't feel like we have a good thing going. So one of the first tricks that I would propose here is the vanishing options test. If you remember the story of Margaret Sanders, she didn't like any of her options for dealing with her receptionist, Anna. She had just brought her on, so she felt guilty for thinking about firing her. But she also couldn't stand to have someone who was not warm and welcoming as the public face of the career placement center that she was running. And if you remember, Margaret Sanders only found a better alternative when she imagined both of her options suddenly vanishing. Suppose you can't fire Anna, but also that you can't afford to have her as the face of the center. What else can you do? And by forcing herself to imagine that situation where her current options had vanished, she had to force herself to sway her mental spotlight to another alternative that turned out to be even better and made the decision quite easy. So for Margaret Sanders, one of the reasons that she was struggling is because she wasn't thinking about the right alternatives in the first place. So instead of agonizing, ask yourself, can I create a better option? Don't think of yourself as an analyst who has to make decisions among imperfect alternatives. Think of yourself more as an explorer who's dedicated to finding new alternatives, or to a designer who's in charge of creating the perfect alternative from the bits and pieces of alternatives that are the most compelling. And the evidence says that if we have a couple of alternatives, a couple of good alternatives, we become bolder decision makers. We become faster decision makers. Remember Kathy Eisenhardt's study that said that the Silicon Valley executives who walked into decisions with multiple alternatives responded faster to the quick movements that were necessary in a fast-paced industry like Silicon Valley. You don't get stuck agonizing about one alternative that looks like it's going south because there's another alternative that you can immediately jump to. And so if we can force ourselves to find a wider set of alternatives, we're going to be making better decisions and bolder decisions. Now notice that we've just talked about the widen your options part of the RAP framework. And in fact, the next part of the framework, reality testing our assumptions, is also useful because one of the reasons we often agonize about decisions is we haven't collected the right information about those options. Margaret Sanders had a problem with alternatives. Steve Cole, the nonprofit group Hope Lab, remember that he had plenty of alternatives, he just didn't have the right information about them. He was trying to decide which design firm would be the right partner for working on the project about how can we use technology to help kids become better exercisers, to lose more weight. And he had several options that were compelling. But how do you make a decision about a long-term project based on cursory information that you get from a project proposal or a couple of meetings with the designers? And remember what Steve Cole did to stop agonizing about whether he was making the right call. He postponed the decision by thinking and, not or. And he decided to hire five different design firms to do the first stage in a scaled-down process. And what he found was that by experimenting his way, by ooching his way into that decision, he was able to resolve a lot of the anxiety because he was able to see how people reacted on a real problem in a real circumstance in his context. He said, you know, what we found is that you don't need to assign somebody a $100,000 project. In fact, you find that you get most of the same good ideas for $20,000, a smaller chunk of the project, that you do for the full project. And now you've got five different firms competing for your business. You've got five different firms telling you their best ideas. And it's putting you in a position to look back with the right information and think about who the right person to partner with is. Ooching is a way of collecting relevant factual data that simplifies a decision. So remember CarsDirect.com? They were having strategy arguments in the entrepreneurial firm about whether it was even possible to sell cars over the internet. This was in the early days of the internet where nobody had ever sold anything as expensive as a car. And rather than agonizing about that, rather than conducting elaborate market surveys, they actually decided, well, let's try it. Let's sell one car. And so in one night, what they found is that they sold three. And that resolved the question forevermore about whether people would buy an expensive big-ticket item over the internet. Now, what I love about that example is it was an easy experiment to run, but it would have been a hard decision to make otherwise. In the absence of that information from that tiny little ooch, the one night of selling one car, they could have agonized for months and delayed their decision indefinitely. So the principle is, if we want to make better, less agonizing decisions, let's reality test our assumptions. Let's do it quickly, let's ooch into it, and move on to the real part of the decision process. Now, occasionally you'll be in the happy situation of having multiple good options. You've collected the information, and nothing's edging ahead. Then the first thing you've got to realize is, congratulations, you've already made a good decision, no matter what you pick. And in fact, in the early drafts of the book, Dan and I had a phrase for decisions like that. We call them coin flippers. That if you've got multiple options that you love, you might as well flip a coin. Now, people hated that. And I think they hated it because we want a reason for making a decision. We're not content to say that if, you know, we've been thinking about things for days and both option A and B look pretty good and I can't decide between them, we don't want to leave it to a coin flip to decide. And that's why we were really excited when we found the Andy Grove example. Because Andy Grove had a decision that he had to make that was really important, really essential to the firm. Should we stay with our historical strengths in making memories, or can we afford to abandon that and go full force into the microprocessor domain? It was a decision that struck to the very core of the identity of what Intel was. And notice that the firm had spent a year and a half agonizing about that decision at the point when Andy Grove turned to Gordon Moore and he said, "Gordon, what if our successor, what if we were fired and our successor came in? What do you think our successor would do?" And both Gordon Moore and Andy Grove admitted that, you know, the successor would get us out of memories and go full force in microprocessors. And that bit of attaining distance, I think, is a brilliant insight. And again, for those of us who are agonizing about a decision, the same principle that's going to help us make a better decision is also going to help us reduce agonizing. Intel had been at the process for a year and a half. There's a case study in the clinics in the back of the book, Sophia, who'd been agonizing about a personal decision. She wasn't meeting the kind of people that she wanted to establish a long-term personal relationship with in the town of Fort Wayne where she was working. And her question was, should I move to Chicago? And I actually sat with a group of people at dinner one night with Sophia and listened to her talk about this decision that she had been agonizing about, her coworker said, for about a year. And yet that simple question about what would you advise your best friend to do in the situation, we asked that to Sophia, and she immediately blurted out, "Oh, move to Chicago." And then she kind of looked surprised at herself. It's like, why was it so easy for me to advise my friend, and yet I've been agonizing about this decision for a year? There's something clarifying about attaining some distance. Now, very often when we give people advice about a decision, we say to sleep on the decision. Well, sleeping on it takes 8 hours. And notice that Sophia and Andy Grove, once they asked the right question, they were able to make the right decision within a couple of minutes. Now, that's a pretty strong advantage in speed. 8 hours is 480 minutes. That's about a 480-to-1 ratio if you can make the best friend decision in a minute. And if you think about Andy Grove or Sophia's decision, they were actually unfolding over the course of months. And so there's a huge advantage, if we're agonizing about a decision, to stepping back and using one of those questions to get a little distance. One final observation. Much of our indecisiveness is driven about worry about what the world is going to bring to us. We get worried about the potential consequences of the decision, and our mind spins. We get into a situation where we agonize about a decision because we don't know if we can cope. And research on coping says that anxiety and stress happen when the demands of the situation exceed our capacity to cope. Now, what's interesting is that if we're prepared for setbacks, the research says that we're more able to marshal the resources that we need to cope effectively with a bad situation. The realistic job preview literature says that if we prepare in our minds for the worst that can happen in a job, if the bank teller is prepared for the customer that's yelling at him or her because, you know, through no fault of the bank teller's, you know, something the bank has done has upset the customer. If you're mentally prepared for that situation, you're going to be more able to cope with it online. You're more likely to say the right thing. You're more likely to keep your calm in that situation. And so the advice that we have in the model to prepare to fail is useful advice in terms of reducing agonizing for decisions. Sometimes when people are making a decision they're agonizing about, we say, think about the worst that can happen. Now, it's a little crazy that thinking about the worst that can happen can make the decision easier. But I think the reason it works is because as our mind spins, we're thinking of 53 different things, ways that something can go wrong. But in fact, only one of those 53 ways can ever happen at any one time. And so if we're thinking about even the worst of the 53 things, that's much better and a more positive outcome than the combination of 53 things kind of fuzzy in our brains. Sandra, in a chapter on preparing to be wrong, was negotiating with her boss for a raise. She imagined how things could go wrong and prepared a plan so that when things did go wrong, because her boss did in fact push back on her request, but even when that could have derailed the event, she was able to stay calm and continue the conversation because she had simulated it in her mind before the fact. Tripwires allow us to ensure that we don't throw good money after bad. So if your spouse wants to start a new business you're skeptical about, set a tripwire. And so if your family can afford to risk $5,000 on the business to get started, then set the tripwire that, you know, we'll reevaluate this thing after we've spent $5,000. And what's beautiful about that is you've given your spouse some run room for the decision. You know that things are never going to go too far south because you've set a target and say, we're going to reevaluate, we're going to shut this down if we don't have progress by $5,000. But in the meantime, you can relax. Your spouse can pursue his or her dream, and you don't have to worry because you know that the right decision is going to be made at the time when the tripwire is struck. By preparing to be wrong, you take away some of the fear because you know that no matter what happens, you're going to be ready for it. You're going to be able to cope with it. And notice that we just used all the principles that we talk about in the RAP framework for making better decisions. We use those same principles to make more confident, bolder decisions. We're not going to be agonizing about situations because we're competent and capable of handling those situations. Margaret Sanders had been agonizing for weeks about what to do with Anna. But while widening her options, she found an alternative that was so obviously better that she could get over her 2 a.m. moments. She could go back to sleep and not worry about the Anna decision. Steve Cole at Hope Lab could have agonized about which design company would be the right partner. But instead of acting on limited information, he went out and reality tested his assumptions. He inched his way into the relationship by giving each one of the design firms a small part of the project and seeing how they performed on that part. And that gave him better information to decide on the right firm without agonizing. By attaining some distance, Andy Grove resolved in a couple of minutes a decision that Intel had been debating for 1.5 years. Sophia made her personal decision about the move to Chicago to enhance her personal life, a decision that she had been agonizing about for a year. The right question about what would I advise my best friend to do enabled to make her to make that decision clear to herself within a minute. Finally, by preparing to be wrong, we don't have to fear what might happen because we'll be prepared for setbacks. We'll be ready to cope with them. One of my favorite stories in the book is the David Lee Roth story. And by setting a tripwire, David Lee Roth allowed himself to move to a different city every couple of days with the band and to know that things were going to go okay for the show that night. So rather than agonizing in the first few chords of every song, you know, is something going to go wrong? Is the mechanical effect going to go wrong? Is the pyrotechnics going to go wrong? He was able to walk in and look for that brown M&M and use that tripwire to say either things are okay, we're on track, we're going to have a good show, or, you know, we better worry, we better line check the contract, we better make sure that things are right. David Lee Roth was smart enough to stop agonizing and take an action to prepare to be wrong that enabled him to relax in the situations where the tripwire wasn't tripped. So what I'm proposing, we talk at the end of the book about procedural justice and the importance in groups of having a process for a decision that's transparent and fair. Let's use a little procedural justice with ourselves. So the next time you wake up at 2 a.m., if you've gone through the RAP process, you say to yourself, look, I've done everything that I can do. I've considered good options. I was realistic about my assumptions. I collected the right information. I chose wisely at the time, I attained some distance, and I honor my core priorities. And look, I've got contingency plans in case something goes wrong. I think I'll get back to sleep. Good luck with your 2 a.m. moments. Mm-hmm.